Session number 3166.
Vice Marshal Capel Reel 2. We were talking about your life, social life at Cranwell. What sort of things did you do in the evenings? Did life revolve round the mess in the evenings?
Oh, very much so. For the same reasons. No one had cars, so we really couldn't get away. And didn't particularly want to get away. I was a bridge player, so I played a certain amount of bridge in the evenings. Not a great deal. Apart from that, I don't remember any particular... We had a guest night, of course, I think once a week, which... was not normal in those days, and apart from that, the local inhabitants were most terribly good to us, and that made a great difference. First of all, we were definitely welcomed in the hunting field, and both the Blankney and the Beaver, whose countries joined at the end of the aerodrome, allowed us to hunt for a very, very small subscription compared with what was then the subscription for civilians. And normally the Beaver were near us on Tuesdays and the Blankneys on Saturdays, and those were the 2 days when we could hunt. Few officers, of course, had more than one horse, and therefore you had to select your days. And then the Beagles, first of all, the masters of foxhounds were very, very keen that we should hunt as much as possible over their lands, over their countries, made no objections at all. And the local inhabitants nearly always asked us for a lawn meat. And so we got to know a vast section of the locals, including farmers, which is very nice.
There's no sense in which being an RAF officer was regarded as rather unfashionable in comparison to, say, some of the best army regiments.
I think as far as Cranwell in those days was concerned, definitely not. We were accepted as the same class, for want of a better word, as the average army officer, and accepted in the same way as they would have been.
What sort of activities did the cadets pursue at leisure time activities at Cranwell? Did they hunt as well?
I don't remember any cadet actually having a horse, though I think one or two may have hired. It was possible to hire horses locally. Some of them, not very many, came out beagling, but some did. And of course, they were roped in for games. I mean, they all had to play something. Most of them keen on either hockey or rugby or cricket or something.
Well, again, what about in the evening? Do you remember at all what went on?
No, nothing in particular.
Were you a relatively sober and hard-working crowd at Cranwell, do you think?
Well,
were there any hijinks?
Well, the normal hijinks you'd get in any station, but certainly there was no, with perhaps one or two exceptions, there were no hard drinkers. We were all, most of us, were keeping very fit to play games. We didn't want to get unfit through drink.
The drinkers were on the staff rather than the cadets, you mean?
The cadets didn't have much chance. I don't think they were allowed to.
Was the discipline fairly strict?
Quite strict, yes.
Was there a great deal of what one might think of as drill and this sort of thing for the cadets? Sort of discipline?
Oh, yes, the drills were very much part of the daily routine, and Church parade on Sunday was quite a parade. We had a station band, and we had a church in one of the hangars, which became quite famous until they built the present new one. Talking about drill, actually, four of the officers and two flight sergeants were sent at the beginning of January to the Guards Depot at Wellington Barracks, where we were put through about a fortnight's course of Guards drill, in other words, proper square bashing. And that was leading up to the cadets arriving at Cranwell and being introduced to that sort of parade drill.
Did you actually drill them, or was that the sergeants?
No, officers. Oh. Officers took church parades anyway. The sergeants, of course, would do most of the elementary square bashing.
So your drill, in fact, was at Cranwell, was modelled on that of the Guards?
Oh, very much so, very much so. Yeah.
Were the cadets, you say people didn't have cars there, so it was difficult to get away. Were they, in fact, free to do as they liked at the weekend? Could they have... Did the cadets go home at weekends, or did they have to stay?
You mean, could they? Were they allowed to go home?
Oh, I think were they so. Allowed out of the? Out
well,
of
I think
camp
I think at weekends they could get a pass for the weekend. I think we were a long way from a station. Really, Grantham was the sort of mainline London station, that sort of thing. And two brothers called Ford used to run a sort of little taxi service from the camp to anywhere you wanted to go in a couple of old Fords, the real old Fords, and they were very useful. They became quite part of the camp.
Was the pay reasonable? Could you maintain a reasonable standard of living?
Well, in those days, I don't remember. We thought very much about pay. It was adequate for what we wanted to do, and that's all we worried about.
Did the hunting cost money?
Well, yes, up to a point. As I say, the subscriptions to the two packs were extremely low. The hay and corn, etc., was bought centrally by the hunt club, and therefore we got it reasonably cheap. And I can't remember the actual sort of expenses, but it was within one's reasonable pay, I think. Though in those days, I think probably a good many of us had a bit of private income as well, but very small indeed.
It wasn't regarded as essential to have a private income.
Oh, Lord, no. Mm-hmm. No.
You spent nearly 3 years at Cranwell, and then in...
4 years at Cranwell.
4 years. Mm-hmm. Then in 1923, you were posted to serve with the RAF in India. Was that your own choice?
I was asked whether I would like to go to Iraq or to India when the time came for posting, and as two of my greatest friends at Cranwell were also going to Iraq, I said I'd like to go to Iraq, whereupon I was promptly posted to India, which I never regretted.
You were initially posted to RAF base at Umballa. What were your first impressions of the base when you got there? Something of a change from Cranwell.
Oh, yes. I took over 5 Squadron, which were Bristol fighters. And it was a single squadron station, and we cooperated with the army units round about that area. And, of course, India was quite new to me. I'd never that served even in Egypt or that part during the First War. And it took a little time to get into the swing of things, but commanded a squadron before, so it wasn't anything particularly new. Right? By the time I got there, the condition of aircraft and engines and spares had enormously improved. And although quite shortly before I took over, I was told that it was quite lucky if you had about three or four aircrafts able to fly at the same time, the rest being unserviceable for want of various spares. By the time I got there, the things had very much improved, and within 3 months, we flew the whole squadron from Mbala to Dardani in Waziristan without any trouble. And 31 squadron came down from Dardani to Mbala with all their aircraft, also, as far as I know, without any trouble. What? Up till then, when the squadrons had changed, they left their aircraft behind and the personnel were changed. We were the first squadron to change over with all our aircraft.
Were you using Bristol fighters throughout your period in India up to 1928?
Yes, just before the end, we were getting the first Wapiti for trial. And we also were given two Siskins, though I can't quite remember why, as they were single-seater fighters and there was nothing to fight. But I think it was something to do with hot weather trials or something. But up to the time when I left, we were still entirely Bristol's as far as our work was concerned.
Were there any problems with the Bristol fighter on account of the climate?
No, they rather struggled up to the heights we wanted over Waziristan, but they did a marvellous job of work, and we had, of course, extremely good mechanics in those days, and the aircraft and the engines, including the overhaul of the engines, was absolutely first class.
Were they relatively reliable, or did a lot of work, in fact, have to be done on them? Were they getting quite old by that stage?
Oh, yes, but definitely, especially the engines, which had been overhauled and overhauled, were certainly getting a bit worn out, I think. For all I remember, towards the end, I didn't make a complaint about the state of some of the engines in the squadron, which had been overhauled so many times, but nothing had happened by the time I left.
Were they liable to let you down while you were actually in the air?
No, not to any degree at all, really. Simply the amount of maintenance required to keep them going.
Well, what was life? You mentioned that it took a little while to adjust to Indian conditions. What was life like for you as RAF officers at Mbala?
Oh, very good, Father.
What were your quarters and so on?
The the mess, as far as I remember, was a largish house, and the quarters were round about in bungalows. Funnily enough, don't remember very well the layout of the officers' quarters at Mbala. But I know mine was a rather large, bare room, and chief thing I remember was rats running about in the roof at night, but they didn't worry me much underneath.
Did you have much trouble with insects and other creatures?
Well, of course, one had mosquito nets. You always slept under a mosquito net. But otherwise, I don't remember anything particular.
What was the daily routine for you as an RAF officer? The working day to begin with.
Well, flying was the main thing. Certainly in the mornings.
Did you start with a parade in the morning?
Yes. Oh yes, there was colour hoisting every morning, which was a parade and prayers, and that was, I think, common throughout the Air Force. We had that every morning.
And then what were the morning duties normally?
Well, at that time, this was January and February, of course, was the fine weather period, and as far as I remember, we were engaged in a good many practice camps, as they were called, with the various army units round about. I was only at Mbala for under 3 months, and curiously enough, it's a great blank in my detailed memory, really. I don't remember very much about it.
You served at a number of other places in India. Can you remember, just to outline what the sequence of postings was that you did in the 5 years that you were there?
Well, in March 1924, that's to say, after 3 months at Mbala, we went to Dardoni. As I said, that was the furthest aerodrome right out in Waziristan. And I was there a complete year, then went to Kohat, which had been used before but had been refurbished to a great extent just before we went there. And we were only there 6 months when it was decided that at Rizalpur, where two bomber squadrons were, 27 and 60, that 60 should go to Kohat, and the 25, an Army Cooperation Squadron, should go to Rizalpur. And we therefore swapped over in about September or October, I think it was, 1924. And from then on, 25, I'm sorry, 25. And from then on, I was at Rizalpur until I came home.
Which were the squadrons then at Rizalpur? Your own was...
Five and 27. And 60 went to Kohat.
Were most of these... were conditions similar in as regards living conditions and so on? Were they similar at most of these places?
Dardoni was very hutted, no proper buildings at all. And when we left, the whole station was demolished, with the exception of the mosque, which was left standing. And the work from Dardoni was done from flights which were occupied Miran Shah at intervals. Well, moved to Miran Shah. The aerodrome at Dardoni really stretched down to Miran Shah, the fort at Miran Shah, which was the Tochi Scouts fort. And the same aerodrome was used, but the aircraft were built little sort of mutty hangars inside the fort for, I think, 6 aircraft. And that became the replacement for Dardoni.
What was social life like for RAF officers in these various postings? How did you fill your leisure time?
Well, Dardoni was, of course, completely cut off. No wives were allowed there, and you couldn't go out other than by air without going down the road to Banu, which of course had to be open at the time you went, so that practically speaking we were marooned at Dardoni except flying out by air. But there again, games. We played hockey and we played soccer. And we had one Indian Army regiment there who were very nice. We mixed a lot with them and entertained each other in our messes, played tennis with them and so on. And they were the first Indian Army regiment which was being Indianized. And they had no white officer, no British officer, under the rank of captain. All the subalterns were Indians.
Did you have separate messes, the RAF and,
yes.
the Army?
Yes, we had separate messes. Quite close to each other.
But nevertheless, you saw quite a good, socially, you saw quite a good deal of the Army people.
Oh, yes. And two of their subalterns were quite good tennis players, and we played a lot of tennis with them.
So once again, there was no kind of snobbery between the old service and the new service?
No, I'd say absolutely none.
Let's talk now then about the kind of work that your role as an Army Corporation Squadron involved. What were the different functions that you performed when you were operating in close support of the Army?
Well, our job in Waziristan was to patrol the area regularly. We did a lot of photography. The mapping, air mapping of Waziristan was in full force then. Number 31 had started it. And then at times we had to do demonstrations over recalcitrant tribes, which might or might not, in many cases didn't, lead ultimately to bombing.
With regard to the aerial mapping that you were doing of Waziristan, what were the was that rather a tricky business?
Well, it was tricky in two ways. First of all, it was not very often that we really got completely clear sky for any length of time. There was always a few clouds about and mist rising, that sort of thing. And one had to snatch the fine days, really good days, when you could stay up for a couple of hours and really do runs, several runs. And then, of course, there was tremendous variation in the height of the ground underneath you, because it gradually, Waziristan gradually rose from the plains round about Tonk and Banu up to the high range just on the border of Afghanistan, which as far as I remember was over 10,000 feet. But the problem of map of photographic interpretation was done. We had two officers, one Royal Engineer and one other officer who I think was seconded to the mapping section in some way. And they did all the interpretation. We just handed in the results, the negatives, and they did the rest. And gradually the map was built up, but it was also usually rather bumpy, and it was difficult to keep the aeroplane quite level. You can see that if the aeroplane was bumping about, the photos taken were apt to be off the direct line of what you were trying to do. However, a map was gradually built up, but I don't think it was ever of any great value. But where photography really came in and we could do, and that was to take detailed photos of what became known as target areas. That could be done in great detail.
When you were working in cooperation with the Army, say doing reconnaissance or artillery spotting for them, how did you communicate with the troops on the ground?
Well,
what were they with you?
A scheme was devised called message picking up, where a string with a message bag was hung between two poles at about 6 foot off the ground, and you had a hook which you could let down below the aircraft, and by flying very low between these two poles, you could pick up the string and then haul in the message, and you could answer it by dropping a message bag back at the point where you picked up.
But, did that require a lot of practice?
It required quite a lot of, more than you'd imagine, because most places were pretty tricky. They weren't straightforward. What you could do in practice on your own aerodrome and think, well, that's too easy, when you got out to the actual spot where it had to be done properly, then very often there were difficulties of terrain, which made it rather tricky. And one of the things we had to do was to train the army personnel where it was safe and where it wasn't safe to put out their message picking up poles. As far as I remember, there was a white strip laid on the ground which led to the middle of the poles, and that gave you the guide of where to fly in.
Did the army tend to put them then just where there was a hill or something?
Well, they didn't all realise the amount of space you required after picking up before while you were still low, which had to be free of hills or scrub or what have you.
And were there any other means of communication besides the message picking up system?
Well, we had we certainly had wireless, and as far as I remember, that was entirely Morse code. We certainly had no two-way RT in those days.